Well, I'm looking forward to this tonight. The founder, publisher of Skeptic Magazine, our guest, Dr. Michael Shermer. We're also talking with him about the science of good and evil and a number of other topics. We'll be right back with Michael Shermer on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Michael Shermer is the founder, publisher of Skeptic Magazine, the director of the Skeptic Society, a monthly columnist for Scientific American, the host of the Skeptics Distinguished Science Lecture Series at the California Institute of Technology, the editor of a webpage called skeptic.com, and the co-host and producer of a Fox Family television series called Exploring the Unknown. Dr. Shermer received his BA in psychology from Pepperdine University, his MA in experimental psychology from California State University in Fullerton, and his PhD in history of science from Claremont Graduate University. He's on with us for the full show tonight on Coast to Coast. Michael, welcome to the program. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Always good to get different sides and different views on, and I wanted to get you on today to talk about a lot of things. Also get your reaction to a psychic who was on our program last week and just get your taste of it. But tell me a little bit about how you founded Skeptic Magazine. What was the process to do that?
Well, I had finished my doctorate in the history of science, and I was teaching at Occidental College in Los Angeles, and actually I'd been teaching for quite a while as an adjunct professor at various colleges, and I was just getting bored with teaching and wanted to add something to what I was doing, and so I started the lecture series at Caltech and the magazine, and it just kept growing and growing, and it was just a garage operation. We were literally just working out of the garage while I was teaching, and it just kept getting bigger, and in 1997, my first book came out, Why People Believe Weird Things, and that did well enough that it gave me confidence to be able to just quit my job, which was hard to do. I mean, university position is a pretty cushy, secure kind of thing to do, and, you know, that's what people work for their whole lives. But I'd done it 19 years at that point, so I decided to go ahead and just see if I could edit and write full-time, and so that's what I do now. I have an office and the staff of people, and we do the magazine and the webpage and the lecture series and an annual conference, and I do a university lecture series myself and shows like this. So, you know, our job is, we're twofold, really. We're social activists. You know, we're actively involved in various cultural debates like evolution and intelligent design, of a recent one, for example. But we also do research and investigate claims and study why people believe what they believe.
Now, the word skeptic itself, give me your definition.
It's a thoughtful inquirer is the original Greek meaning. It's really, though, science. Science is skepticism, and skepticism is science. It's not that we don't know anything or believe anything. We believe all sorts of things. It's that we have a fairly high standard of evidence that we require if a claim is extraordinary, that the evidence be extraordinary, to coin a phrase, and that there has to be some way to get at an answer to the claim for us. So, like, for example, on the God question, if it comes down to a matter of faith for a person says, I believe in God because it works for me and I can't prove it, that's really not our domain. In science, there has to be some way to test it for it to be part of science. So if somebody says, you know, I believe in God because of the following arguments and the following pieces of evidence, then we can legitimately ask, well, okay, what is the evidence and how do you know it's true and what's the quality of the evidence and that sort of thing. So as with all science, we have to have some way to test it, or at least theoretically test it. There has to be some way to get at an answer.
You know, so just by the nature of being a skeptic, we're going to have some fun tonight, too, because I'm going to throw some past predictions that have been on the program and get your take on some of these things. The nature of a skeptic generally, though, is not necessarily someone who doesn't believe that unusual things can happen then. It's that you look at it with a more I guess, varied eye, a little more scientific, a little more hesitant before you jump and believe. Would that be pretty accurate?
Yeah, it would. And to refine that slightly more is to say that we're looking for natural explanations. Before we say something is out of this world, let's first make sure that it's not in this world. And by that, I mean, let's look for a sort of natural explanation, a human cause, before we look first for a superhuman cause.
Yet you do believe in some supernatural events?
No.
Actually. Oh, Michael.
Well, okay, here's the problem. What do you mean by supernatural?
Let me say this. Do you believe in ghosts?
No.
You don't believe in ghosts?
No.
Do you believe that there could be beings that live in this universe beyond our planet? Intelligent beings?
Yes, I do.
Do you believe they visited us?
No, I don't.
Okay, so you don't believe that.
But it's not a matter of sort of ticking off the checklist. It's really a way of, it's more of a matter of asking how it is we know these different things.
Do you believe in ESP, extrasensory perception, that some people are more intuitive, let's say, than others?
No, I don't.
Oh, Michael!
I don't, because no one has ever passed any controlled experiments. The kinds of levels of evidence that would be required for any kind of medical or scientific claim, the ESP people have never passed those tests. And if you leave out the goofy television psychic type folks, for over a century now, scientists have studied very rigorously with controlled experiments ESP, and inevitably, they never get statistically significant results, the kind of results you need, say, like with the cold fusion debacle, where no one could replicate the original findings of Pons and Fleischmann. And if you can't replicate the findings of claimed significance, then it's probably pathological science or pseudoscience. It's not that unusual things don't happen. Unusual things happen all the time. The question is, why do they happen, and what's the explanation? And when there isn't a consistent replication of results like with cold fusion or ESP, it's best to just remain skeptical until those corroborative tests come in.
Do you believe in miracles?
It depends how you define a miracle. If you mean by a miracle, like a million-to-one odds of something happening, sure, those kinds of things happen all the time. As I like to say, million-to-one odds happen 8 times a day in New York City. You know, there's 8 million people, and if you have enough stuff going on, the law of large numbers says inevitably unusual things will happen if there's enough stuff happening. If you mean by miracle a suspension of natural law, in which a divine being reaches
steps
down
in
into our world, something like that.
Yeah.
No, I don't.
Oh, my. Okay. Well, let's pick up with this. The Coast to Coast, as you know, is a international program. And we made national news last week when I had psychic Sylvia Brown on the program.
Yes, I recall this.
It was on the very, what I thought was a euphoric night that turned out to be a very sad night of the coal miner situation in West Virginia. Originally, the entire planet had the thought that the 12 of the 13 miners were alive, or under some miscommunications there, really 12 out of 13 had died. Be that as it may, Sylvia was on the program. She was giving us some of her predictions, her past and present. She's had some hits, and I'm sure you'll tell me define hits, but we'll get into that. But it was at the moment where everyone believed that the 12 miners were saved. I, as a newsman, felt a little strange about that. I had asked a reporter who was down there covering the story live if the victims had been brought out yet. And she said, well, I don't think so. I don't know. That bothers me, because I've covered enough of these stories before where when you hear voices of miners, which they didn't even hear, by the way, that doesn't mean they're brought out alive. Anything could happen. Be that as it may, I said to Sylvia, well, Sylvia, in as much as they're alive, and I'm going to ask you this after the fact, how would you have answered the question about are these miners alive? Well, she first of all said, look, I hate, you know, answering questions like that. I hate people who react to things that have already occurred in so many words. But I believe they would have been found. My impressions, Michael, were that she agreed that they were going to be found alive, though she never said that. And then immediately after that, we went to a commercial. We then found out in a bulletin that there was major miscommunication, that the miners were indeed dead, not alive. I came back, and she immediately said, yes, yes, they're dead. I knew they'd be dead. And I then played the tapes throughout the night, letting listeners decide for themselves, you know, what they were going to do. And, I toyed with the idea of confronting her on it at the moment, but I wanted to hear the tapes again because I didn't remember her saying they'd be found alive. I thought, and I was correct, she said they'd be found. Again, I assumed she meant they'd be found alive, but she never said that. What's your take on all that? I know you've read some of the things about that episode.
Yeah, well, my take is she's cagey enough not to have committed herself to one position or the other, and therefore you can't be wrong. And the wording was perfect. They were indeed found.
They were
she
found.
She didn't say they'd be found dead or alive. So, I mean, I take...
Because in some mine explosions, in accidents, the victims are never found.
Right. Oh, well, that's true. Okay, so, yeah.
See,
right.
and that's what I was thinking. Well, maybe she's thinking that.
Yeah. Well, okay, I mean, to be blunt, I don't think Sylvia Brown is psychic. I don't think anybody's psychic. She's probably the least effective of the psychics, television psychics. I think John Edward and James Van Prager are better than she is, although none of them can actually talk to the dead. Or, actually, I should point out, anybody can talk to the dead. It's getting the dead to talk back. That's the hard part.
Yeah.
And so how is it that they appear to be able to get the dead to talk back? And the answer is it's a very interesting psychological trick. It's a magic trick. It's called mentalism, in which you do a cold reading. That is, you literally read somebody cold by starting very broad and general, and you say things like they will be found, you know, something broad like that, and then you focus in more narrowly. I've done this a number of times on radio shows. I did it last time. I did it was for Bill Nye the Science Guy on his TV, his PBS television show.
Yeah.
Which I spent a day doing readings for him in a studio in Seattle, and I was pretty good at it. I mean, the people were stunned. I had them crying and the whole thing, and I did this with no practice at all. And in fact, to make it harder on myself, I did an astrological reading, tarot card readings, palm readings, and psychic readings. And I don't know anything about any of these modalities. I just made stuff up and basically did the same reading, whether I was looking at a chart, a palm, a tarot cards. You know, I just made stuff up and essentially did the same kind of reading. Anybody can do this. This is all in my science fiction, my book, Science Friction, which I describe the kinds of things you should say. And I got all these tips from professional mentalists and magicians who do this. And turns out it's just simple as can be, because people want it to be true. So you start off broad and general and generally kind of positive, and then you get more specific. And there's a number of these things that turn out to be true for most people. Like if a woman has short hair, you say, I think I'm getting that used to wear your hair longer. Or do you have an earring that's missing its match, and you've been hanging onto it to hope to find the missing one? Or to a guy, I'm getting something about her, or he's telling me something, if it's somebody passed over, that you have some tools in the garage that are broken, but you don't want to throw them away. You've been meaning to fix them.
And, they may say, no, they're in the basement.
Yeah, well, and that's fine. You take credit for the hit,
right,
no matter what.
Right.
Or to a woman, you've got some photos. I've seen photographs in a shoebox you've been meaning to put into a photo album. Or I see a calendar on the wall in your house, but it's out of date.
Almost everybody does that.
That's right. It turns out there's dozens, 50, 60 of these things. I list them in my book that you can use that people don't realize that these are true for most people. And when someone passes over, if it's a guy, if it's his dad who passed over, a grandfather, you say, the watch. He's telling me something about the watch. I don't know what this means. And these guys are stunned to hear this because they have their dad's watch or the grandfather's watch. And this is true. When my father passed over, I have his watch. And if you don't know that everybody, all guys, keep their dad's watch, you think that the psychic has scored gold, that, you know, he must somehow be connected to the other side, when in fact that's not the case at all.
So let's assume that some, if not most, are making it up. Maybe they believe they're psychic and they're not. We'll give them a little credit for that. Aren't there, though, there's got to be some shamans out there from ancient lands that have had some incredible abilities to foresee the future and things like that. I mean, don't you think some of them exist somewhere? Maybe we can't explain why, but that they've got some kind of ability?
Well, I remember what Yogi Berra said about predictions. They're hard to make, especially about the future. And, you know, we have to have a baseline from which we compare the person we're testing. And these things are very difficult, as you know. I mean, if somebody says, oh, I see dark clouds over the White House in 2006. Really? What does that mean, dark clouds over the White
House? There's always a dark cloud over a White House.
Or, you know, Paris Hilton will have relationship problems.
Yeah.
Oh, shocking.
Or get into a car accident.
Earthquakes in Southern California. No! And if nothing else, you make 300 or 400 predictions. And, you know, the law of large numbers says you will get some right. Just inevitably, this will happen.
And then you blow those out of proportion? Maybe?
Of course.
The ones that are right?
You publish the correct ones on your webpage, and you just ignore the others. Of course, the skeptics keep track of all the misses. So in science, here's the point. You have to keep track of the hits and the misses and ask, are the number of hits you got statistically significant beyond chance from the total number of predictions that were made? And when these things are recorded correctly, no, the answer is no, that no one can predict the future in that sense. Of course, you know, weather predictions, stock predictions, you know, these are notoriously, well, beyond a few days.
Well, but you can use fact with those.
That's right. And they aren't very good with that. And psychics are even worse than that.
Now, in your particular case, because it's very tough for you to believe these things, was it because you were brought up in a pretty hard-nosed way, unlike maybe some people who might be a little more sensitive to the paranormal?
No, actually, I would have liked these things to be true. My upbringing was not particularly religious or anti-religious or pro-science or anti-science. It had nothing to do with it at all. I got into science because I was thrilled by the exploration of mysteries and that kind of thing. I actually thought there was something to psychics. In the late 70s, I was in a graduate program in experimental psychology, and Uri Geller was all the rage.
Yeah.
Thelma Moss at UCLA doing studies on near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences. And I remember having arguments with my advisor, who was a strict Skinnerian and a materialist. He didn't believe any of this. And we used to argue about this, and I used to make the kind of comments you were making and that other people make, that, you know, there must be something to it. Don't you believe in anything? And so on and so forth. And then I remember seeing the Amazing Randy on The Tonight Show, in which he showed how he could do everything that Uri Geller was doing. And he made an interesting analogy with lab rats and saying, you can't let the rat run the experiment, which is what the psychics do. And I thought, oh, well, because that's what I was doing, running rats in experimental labs. So I got to thinking, yeah, that's right. Gosh, if, you know, these tricks, if this guy can do these tricks and you can't tell the difference between that and the actual so-called real thing, then, you know, maybe science is not so bulletproof here in testing these kinds of people. And that, of course, was Randy's point. You should have a magician present. But in the larger sense, then it started me down the road of being skeptical. Although I still thought there was something to it for a number of years, but the more I read about it, the more discouraged I became that there was a lot of hucksters and hoaxers, and the research was pretty sloppy, and there was a lot of wishful thinking. And I remember trying, when I was a bike racer in the 1980s, I remember trying a lot of sort of performance-enhancing sort of natural herbs and colonics and chiropractic and acupuncture. And I tried hundreds of different things. I was feeling as superstitious as the next guy. Athletes are notoriously superstitious. They'll try anything to improve performance. And I always felt like, you know, sort of deep down that I wasn't being skeptical enough. I wanted these things to be true. And just the more I got into it, the more skeptical I became. It just grew over time as I, you know, kind of looked into these things.
All right. Well, stay with us. Dr. Michael Shermer, our guest all night long, right here on Coast to Coast AM. He's a skeptic. Well, for StreamLink members, tomorrow we'll have our chat, 8 p.m. Pacific time, 11 p.m. Eastern time. We'll sit back and just chat about things and events. So we'll do that tomorrow. So make sure you're part of it right here on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with our guest, Dr. Michael Shermer, right here on Coast to Coast. Michael, do you think that we should continue some serious, let's say, university work into the psychic realm? You know, at Duke University, Dr. J.B. Rhine tried that a long time ago. He's since passed on. Was getting some kinds of results, but unfortunately he passed on and the program died with him. But do you think we need to do good scientific research into this area?
Depends on which area. I think at this point, with things like ESP, PsyPower, and you know, reading the backs of playing cards, Zener cards, whatever, it's been done, gosh, well, since the 1890s, pretty rigorously, and they just have failed to produce replicable results. I would rather see resources put into other mysteries, other things that have not really been tested very well, and in which I think I don't know, things like peak oil, you know, environmental questions about global warming. If you want to study human psychology, I think there's a huge realm there for things like hypnosis, even though that's been studied a lot, but there needs to be more done there, I think. Altered states of consciousness. You know, we don't have a good, we don't have a good scientific explanation for altered states of consciousness, primarily because we don't have a good scientific explanation of consciousness. So if you don't have a good theory of consciousness, how can you have a theory that explains altered states of whatever it is you're studying? So, and by that, I mean the neural correlates of consciousness. I think the guy doing the best work in this field is at Caltech. His name is Christoph Koch, K-O-C-H, Christoph Koch. And his book is The Quest for Consciousness. It's looking for the neural correlates of consciousness. And the problem to explain is how do a bunch of neurons, single individual cells who fire, they release these neurochemical transmitter substances into these little gaps called synapses. How does that somehow translate into pain or music or love or affection or anger and all the thoughts that we have? Nobody actually knows this. We have some ideas, some pretty good ideas, but there is no agreement among scientists about the proper explanation for that. And to me, that's way more exciting than whether people can read each other's thoughts, you know, by looking at remote viewing or, with the little ping pong balls over your eyes and thinking certain thoughts. You know, these guys have been doing this for over a century, and they just don't have anything. So let's move on to something else that we can tackle.
Has anybody wanted to debate you at all, or do you debate them?
I do quite a few debates, actually, probably half a dozen to a dozen a year. The two most popular debates we do on college campuses are the God debate and the intelligent design evolution debate. So I debate a guy named Doug Guyvet, who's a theologian at Biola, at Talbot School of Theology in Biola, which is the Bible Institute of Los Angeles. And he's a really sharp philosopher, and so we've taken this on the road, and you know, he does.
Would you debate some guests that appeared on this program?
Oh, sure.
If we can all set it up?
Oh yeah, sure.
Okay.
Yeah,
good.
I do a lot of that.
We'll do that down the
line. I mean, in a way, debate is a good way to, you know, sort of get the cards on the table. I was glad the intelligent design movement just sort of hit all over the place in the media, because it forced them to show and admit that they did not have any scientific curriculum to teach students. They admitted that in court, you know, under oath.
Right.
We have nothing to teach. It was like, okay, end of story.
Well, now let me ask you this: with the unusual, with the mysteries, with the paranormal, and I ask you this with all respect: what do you believe in?
Well, the normal.
What's normal
and
anymore?
There's plenty of mysteries.
I keep thinking of the old Frankenstein movie with Gene Wilder. And he sent Igor to go get a brain, and Igor comes back. Well, I'll be normal. So I don't know what normal is anymore, Michael.
One of the great films of all time.
Yep.
Well, okay, so when we're talking about normal, all I'm talking about is what the fundamental assumption of science is that there are natural explanations for natural phenomenon. By definition, something that's not natural, supernatural, paranormal, or paranormal, how do you study that? How do you test it, measure it? Once you've identified something Let's say that it turned out there was an extrasensory perceptual force. Let's say it had something to do with quantum mechanics, and that when neurons fire in my skull, somehow this tweaks the ether, the psychic ether, and it goes across space and into your skull, and you can sense what I'm thinking. Let's say that's true, and that we've identified the mechanism.
Sure.
It's this quantum effect or whatever. Well, that's no longer the paranormal. That's now just part of the normal realm of science, much like television waves or radio waves or, in other words, electromagnetic radiation, for example, simply was incorporated into the natural world as part of science. Same thing with the strong and weak nuclear effect and, all the stuff particle physicists study, quarks and things like
mm-hmm.
that. For somebody a century ago or two centuries ago, this would have looked like the paranormal. But once it's established as part of science, it's no longer the paranormal, and that's the fate of the paranormal. It simply disappears once science gets involved.
See, I've always believed that science and the paranormal overlap, and in some cases, they may be one and the same.
Another way to say that is there is no such thing as the supernatural or the paranormal. There's just the natural, the normal, and all the stuff we can't explain yet, mysteries. So let's go and try to explain them with our natural explanations, and either we will or we won't.
See, I believe in angels, for example. To me, that's not paranormal. I think that's been part of the universe for a long time. I see that as part of science. I believe in miracles. I think some incredible things have happened to some incredible people. I believe that's...
You mean like the Boston Red Sox?
the curse? Yeah, we may go there. But I believe that there is a scientific basis to faith, for example.
Like what? How do you mean that?
Well, if one believes in a God, okay, as I do,
uh-huh.
I don't think you do, but I'll ask you that when we get into it. It could also be that there's a scientific explanation for it, which I don't have, but it may not be just supernatural or just spiritual. It may be something that is part of this universe that if we knew it, if we had that kind of intelligence, it would be a very explainable process and maybe a wonderful process. But I believe that there's an overlap here.
Right. Well, I wrote an essay, and I write a monthly column for Scientific American called Skeptic, and
right.
One of my columns was called Shermer's Last Law, because I don't believe in naming laws after yourself. And my Shermer's Last Law is that any sufficiently advanced extraterrestrial intelligence is indistinguishable from God.
You might be right.
And by that, I mean that if we do encounter an ET, it's not going to be something really close to us technologically and so forth. They're going to be light years ahead of us, because the chances of encountering somebody are pretty slim. And if we do, the chances of them being, just like 10 years ahead of us or 100 years ahead of us are nil, because evolution happens way too slowly over long periods of time. So if we do encounter somebody, they'll probably be, 100,000 years ahead of us or a million
or
years
more,
ahead of
yeah.
us. Or more. And look what we're capable of doing just in the last century, space flight to the moon and telecommunications and cell phones and so on and so forth. To somebody 500 years ago or 1,000 years ago, we would appear godlike and mysterious, paranormal, supernatural, these incredible forces we have. I mean, here we are throwing voices across the ether. I mean, it looks paranormal until you know the technology behind it. This, of course, is Arthur C. Clarke's third law. Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic. It's the same principle. So how would you determine the difference between what you and I would call a god because of his incredible powers and just a really advanced, smart, technologically powerful extraterrestrial?
You wouldn't.
Right.
Other than, eventually, wouldn't you have to ask yourself this? Who made them? And then who made them? If you keep going back?
Yes, indeed. Those are great questions. And then if we decided we found one called God, why couldn't we ask who made God?
Well, I asked my mother that many, many years ago, and she couldn't give me the answer.
And
it was a question that I guarantee you will drive everybody crazy if they try to figure it out.
Well, my debate partner, Doug Guyvet, the theologian, says the answer is God is that which does not need to be caused.
Or it's simply faith.
And to which I say, well, why can't the universe be that which does not need to be caused? And, there we go. So you end up with an infinite regress, and you get nowhere with that. So there are some mysteries that can't be answered. I think that's one of them. If time is infinite, the universe is infinite, we can't know the beginning. There is no beginning. If it's infinite, there can't be a beginning. So it's kind of pointless. So it's like asking what's north of the North Pole. Nothing. You can't. It's the South Pole is north of the North. I mean, what do you? You can't even ask the question.
Well, how about some of these people, guests, we've had them who have electronic voice phenomena. They come in with incredible sounds. Let's make an assumption they're not making them up, but that they actually go out and record this stuff, and it happens to get on their digital recordings.
Yeah, but most of the things I hear on those are, it's like reminds me of when we used to play Beatles albums backwards when I was a kid, and you'd hear all these weird noises, and you'd hear words, sort of, or phrases, or broken phrases.
Well, some of them were put in that way.
Yeah, well, okay, so, you know, how do we tell the difference between noise and signal? Signal and noise problem. And,
I mean, some of them, Michael, you can hear. I mean, again, I guess let me ask you this. You think they're making them up?
I think people are hearing. Look, humans are pattern-seeking animals. We find patterns all over the place. Sometimes the patterns are real, sometimes they're not. Science is the best tool we have for determining whether a pattern is real or not. The problem with electronic voice phenomena, like any kind of subjective experience like that, where the noise, where the signal is very fuzzy and blends in closely with the background noise, and it's hard to tell, the mind fills in the gap. It's really hard to say whether it's actually a word or did I hear that in my own mind.
Okay, but I've heard some. I mean, I've heard them where they're, let's say, in the basement of a house that had burned down 100 years ago and a little girl died. And all of a sudden you hear on this EVP, you know, "Mommy, save me." And it's very hard to make out.
Uh-huh.
But there is a sound there, and it could sound like that.
You know, there's an interesting research by a British psychologist named Diana Deutsch at UC San Diego, who does audio illusions, sort of like, you know, we're all familiar with visual illusions. You see them in the psych textbooks kind of thing. But she does audio illusions, and she came up and did a lecture for us at Caltech and had dual speakers set up with a really nice stereo system where she played these little tape loops. She had hundreds of them, of which just little snippets of words that you loop together very rapidly. And if you play them long enough, it's so interesting how all of a sudden words start coming out of these little tape loop noises. But everybody in the audience, when she did it for us, there was about 300 people present. We all heard different words and different phrases, and her research on this shows it's very interesting that subjects that are hungry, for example, will tend to hear words that are related to food. Guys tend to hear a lot of sex-related words. And, you know, women hear more love-related words. And it's very interesting. It depends on what's on your mind, what you're worried about, what you're anxious about. When the signal is really fuzzy and noisy, your mind fills in the gaps there with whatever is on your mind. And it's kind of scary in a sense. It's one of the reasons it's scary in the sense that we don't really know reality like we think we do. And it's one of the reasons science requires that you have these double-blinded experiments, because the experimenter bias is a serious problem where experimenters, researchers themselves hear what they want to hear, see what they want to see. And that's why you need to control for that.
In the old days, they used to have boxers, you know, fight everybody in the round, in this boxing match. You know, he'd be there by himself, and he'd have all these challengers, and he'd knock them all out one at a time. But in some cases, he fought five or six people. What I might do with you in this debate is bring them all in every half hour, but keep you in the ring by yourself.
Fine. No problem.
And they come in, and it's your job. That, like, I want to bring in Hoagland, maybe Stanton Friedman,
sure.
A whole bunch of other people. Bring them on and see what can happen to you. I wonder if you'd get exhausted and roughed up.
$1 million baby.
Yeah, exactly. We'll do that. We'll do that as a show. That'll be quite the program. Would you like to believe that some of these mysteries are unusual and paranormal? Deep down inside, isn't there a part of you that would love this to happen?
Yeah, there is. I'm particularly fascinated by the extraterrestrial question. I think it's one of the greatest questions ever asked. You know, are there extraterrestrials out there? And, you know, we think of it as something that's sort of a 20th century phenomenon. It's not. It goes all the way back to the ancient Greeks, the speculation of life elsewhere in the cosmos. And this debate's been around for several thousand years. And humans have always filled in the celestial spheres with intelligent beings, whether they're angels, gods, God, or various kinds of theories about life on other planets. They're inevitably portrayed as more advanced than us, more moral than us, more intelligent than us, really godlike. And I think there's something in the human psyche that drives us to see that, envision that. I mean, let's face it, there's no data. The SETI people, who the scientists search for extraterrestrial intelligence, they have no more data for their subject than the UFO people. And no one has any data. We don't have a shred of evidence that the ET is out there. But, you know, the arguments are damn good that, you know, it'd be a pretty amazing thing if we were the only ones. You know, it's a big place, a lot of planets and so on. So I would be surprised if we were alone. I'm sure we're not alone.
See, I think we've been visited before. I mean, with not the kind of technology we understand. You know, they somehow, if they're as advanced as you had mentioned, if they're out there, you know, I think maybe they came through some kind of wormholes or portals or something, because they can't get here conventionally. There's no way.
Uh-huh.
I mean, even that, yeah. I'd admit that.
It's too big, yeah.
But I do believe something unusual has happened to this planet. Maybe we were genetically altered. Maybe we were jump-started. But something very strange happened here a long time ago.
Well, if that's the case, say the genetic thing, it would have to be all the way back at the beginning, because we are all,
oh, sure, I agree,
us to plants and, you know, worms and everything genetically. You know, you can see the sequence quite continuously there. But of course, that just begs the question: if we're back to the infinite regress, where did those aliens evolve? Assuming evolution works the same way everywhere in the cosmos, then they would have had to evolve from somewhere.
Well, I think being a skeptic is healthy, because I think it's important to get different views on, and it's critical to this program, for example, with all the kinds of people we bring forward, to let people sit back and make up their own minds, that we also bring in someone like you who comes at it from a different perspective. I think that's healthy, don't you?
Absolutely. That's our job. I tell you one thing I would not like to be true. I actually would not want ESP to be true. I think people's private thoughts really need to be private, because if we all knew what we were thinking about each other, oh, man.
My aunt, who is dead, who got her medical degree from Oxford, she decided to change her entire medical career and devoted it to the search for extrasensory perception, telekinesis. She was obsessed with that. Unfortunately, she died tragically, Michael, but she was one of the foremost authorities in this country to want to take a scientific approach to these things. Wrote a book called Breakthrough to Creativity. Came up with some startling things, and maybe that's one of the reasons I take the perspective I take. And then in her life cut short when an electronics appliance fell into her tub.
Oh, God.
Now, you talk about being skeptical. I sometimes think somebody pushed it. I mean, she was getting close to some marvelous things that, a lot of us would have loved to.
Well, questions like creativity and genius, we really don't understand these. You know, these autistic savants, you know, they're all good at two things, music and calendric calculation. You know, there's something about that we don't fully understand that's going on in the brain there. You know, the Rain Man, the original Rain Man.
Yeah.
Last issue of Scientific American has a terrific story on this guy. He's phenomenal. But they got the brain scans in there. His brain is huge. And it's not divided like normal brains are. It's more integrated. And there's something about this that we don't understand yet. I think the great mysteries are not, you know, in the realm of the paranormal. Hell, I don't think we know the normal very well.
All right. Well, when we come back, we'll continue talking with you about skeptics. We're also going to talk about the science of good and evil. And then later on tonight, we'll open up the phone lines. We'll give you an opportunity to talk with the founder, publisher of Skeptic Magazine, Dr. Michael Shermer. I'm George Norrie. Back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.